It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, Attorney General Eric Holder signaled that the federal government will no longer interfere in states that allow commercial sale of marijuana as long as it's strictly regulated.
This comes 2 years after the Justice Department began a campaign to shut down dispensaries and growers around the country.
And earlier this summer, Illinois legalized medical marijuana, meaning that this new policy would affect about 20 states and the District of Columbia, where pot is legal in some form.
Marijuana has a complicated history here in the United States. It's been seen as a demon in the war on drugs, an icon of the counterculture, and a drug prescribed for the side effects of chemotherapy.
Here to put cannabis in historical perspective is author Martin A. Lee. His new book is Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. Martin, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we get into the history, and I think that's where we're going to spend a lot of the time, what do you think of this news? Eric Holder saying the feds might back off from states allowing pot sales.
It could be very significant. It could be a game changer. But the way the guidance memo to the prosecutors around the country was couched by the Justice Department, it really left a lot of leeway. It really left all the options on the table. If certain things do happen or certain things don't happen, the federal government reserves the right to intervene in these states. But how they would actually intervene and how effective that would be is really an open question, because one of the ironies of cannabis is that it's a controlled substance, yet its use proliferates in an uncontrolled manner.
Well, marijuana is nothing new, of course. It goes back way before the existence of the United States. How back do you trace it back? When were people, as far as we can tell, first using pot?
Probably before actually the written word, before prehistory. But we know, for example, in ancient China, the first pharmacopoeia, the first assemblage of medicines by a human culture, mentions cannabis, or specifically it was ma in ancient China, medicinal hemp, as it being a very special medicinal herb. They considered it a treatment for over 100 different conditions. So it goes back at least 2,000 years before Christ.
And do you get a sense of what people were using it for then?
You know, all kinds of things. And interestingly, you know, many of the same conditions that people today in the United States who are using medical marijuana claim benefit for them. From arthritis, rheumatism, nausea, a whole host of different conditions that was used effectively, apparently, in ancient China. And interestingly enough, also today.
Is this one of the crops that was in the old world, but not the new? And if so, when did it first arrive here in the West?
It is. Origins go back to really Central Asia. The plant migrated from there along with human beings as they traveled. It came over to the Western Hemisphere aboard the seeds, aboard slave ships. So it's really before, it's really the... It comes along with Columbus and the slave ships that followed. So it's it was brought over as seeds from African slaves to South America, also to Mexico. And from there, the plants, which was considered quite useful for many reasons, you know, traveled up from the South and Central America into North America.
George Washington grew marijuana. He grew hemp. And there's some controversy, I guess, in the pot research world about what exactly he did with it. What were you able to figure out?
Well, you know, cannabis is really is a two-faced plant in that it can be used for fiber and cloth and for a variety of other industrial uses, and that's what Washington and the founding fathers were interested in. And it can also be used as a medicine or a recreational or a psychoactive substance. Those are different from industrial uses. There's no evidence whatsoever that George Washington or the other founding fathers saw cannabis as something you'd use as a medicine or as a recreational drug. They really saw it for practical purposes, for creating uniforms for their troops and so forth. So really, the confusion stems from the fact that Washington actually talked about growing Indian hemp in his diaries and referred to how he regretted at one point during one of the harvests back in 1765 that he separated the male and female hemp plants, because they come in two sexes, too late it was. And that has resulted in a misperception among cannabis enthusiasts that he was actually growing psychoactive hemp or cannabis, because there's a premium placed on separating female and male plants and growers today, because the female plants are stronger, and if they mix with the males, if the seeds are formed, then it weakens the potency of the herb. But for, in Washington's day, he was concerned with allowing the plants to grow to the full bloom so they can come to seed, and they would have then more hemp plants in the future to create a lot of different goods that they needed those days.
And so hemp, I mean, you mentioned soldiers' uniforms, I imagine ropes on ships. This was a strategic resource the way we think of maybe oil these days.
Well, back in those days, you know, it was sailing ships that really powered the armies and the trade around the world. You had to have good sails for the ships. It was wind power that was used. And the most durable fiber for sails was the hemp cloth, cloth made from hemp, because it was resistant to salt water, as well as being just a tough fiber on its own. So it was considered a strategic substance. The fact that it flourished in the Americas was one of the reasons that Tom Paine wrote about in Common Sense, saying that the Americans should revolt against the British, rebel against the British, because they had enough hemp in the Americas, in the colonies, to go it on their own. And the British, of course, were very upset. They wanted the hemp for themselves because it grew better in the colonies, so they would import it. And that was actually a friction point during the Revolutionary War.
That's the strategic and economic use of hemp. How about the other use, the recreational use, the medicinal use? When did that start coming about and being a big thing in America?
You know, first it came over as a medicine, as tinctures, as droplets, as something, as rubbing oils and so forth. When it was discovered by an Irish scientist and a doctor also in India in the 1830s, it made its way to England and then from England over to the Americas as a medicine initially. But certain people found that if you took a lot of that medicine, it gave you a funny feeling in the head, you know, kind of a mellow, swimmy-headed high, as it were, that we come to associate these days with marijuana. So it was really the medicinal use that gave birth to the recreational use, not vice versa. In modern-day America, it was really the recreational use among people that led them to discover that marijuana had medicinal properties. So it was just the opposite of how it originally occurred in the 19th century in the Americas.
And one of the most, I guess, famous things about marijuana, or what we think of it for, is its association with a counterculture, with artistic culture. When did that association first come to light in this country?
Well, it goes back a ways, you know, to the jazz musicians in the 20th and early 20th century. Louis Armstrong, the jazz great, was a notorious pot smoker. And then the beat writers, such as Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, they wrote about their use of marijuana in their writings. And it was really the beats that introduced marijuana to, not necessarily physically, but the fact that there even was such a thing, it introduced it to mainstream America. The Beats were prominent in the 1950s, that movement, and by the 60s, the counterculture emerged and embraced marijuana as its drug of choice, and millions of Americans, young Americans in the 1960s, began experimenting with marijuana, and that was quite an ironic development because it now had been already illegal for three decades or so, and it was made illegal in 1937 in the United States. And the fact that so many young people would reject the advice of the authorities and embrace marijuana was a very startling development. It raises questions why this happened, what were the factors contributing to so many people using this. It was something from another culture, in a sense. But it's a fascinating part of the story, and it's one of the major plot points, if you will. If you look at the cannabis history in America as a kind of movie, you know, there was always about 30 minutes into the film, some event happens that changed the story and propels it in a different direction. And 1960s was that moment for the cannabis history.
And we'll get into that in more detail in just a few moments. We're talking to Martin Lee about his new book, Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific.
And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the history of marijuana and also the culture that has surrounded marijuana for many years. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can also post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
More discussion with Martin Lee coming up about the role of marijuana in American law, order, and counterculture. You're listening to Central Time.
Thanks, Noah. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. We continue our conversation now with Martin Lee about his book, Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific, talking about the history of marijuana in the United States, its role in American culture. We'll get your calls in just a few moments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. First, Martin, though, you were talking about this this key development in the history of marijuana in the United States. First, why did it become illegal, and really quite illegal?
It became illegal in 1937, and largely because of the bureaucratic maneuverings of the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. His name was Harry Anslinger. You know, this was the Depression in the 1930s. There was budget cutbacks. His entire department was on the chopping block, and he basically had to invent a reason to convince Congress and the American public that his department was very necessary, because there was this evil weed throughout the land that could only be combated by a well-funded Federal Bureau of Narcotics. So that's the origins of the Reefer Madness campaign. It was steeped in racism. Anslinger associated with Mexican-Americans and African-Americans, marginalized groups in American society. But the main reason for this was he's basically trying to preserve his own job. And the myth that he set in motion, you know, oddly enough, has stuck with us in many ways. And we can look back at that time of Reefer Madness and kind of laugh at it now and think, oh, that's ridiculous, the idea of a person takes a puff of marijuana and, like in the movie Reefer Madness, go out and kill somebody. We know that's a big joke. And yet, many of the same themes that Anslinger introduced kind of keep reappearing, sort of like as a almost like a Reefer Madness light. You know, we're still told today that marijuana can cause schizophrenia and psychosis, that it could make a young person's IQ drop, that it injures the brain, and there's really no science behind these allegations, and yet they still with us and linger on with in the culture. So although Anslinger died in 1975, his legacy really does live on.
And then you talked about, despite this thing being illegal, the use of it exploded in the 60s. It became super commonplace. Why did that happen?
I think there's many reasons that contributed to that. There was a spirit of rebellion in the air in the 1960s. Young people embraced marijuana in part as a way of expressing their rejection of the dominant culture. But I think it also had to do with another factor that I kind of imply in the book but don't explicitly discuss. And that, the fact of the matter is, that generation that came of age in the 1960s was the first generation that came of age under the shadow of the atomic bomb, the mushroom cloud. It was the first generation that grew up realizing that they can wipe out humanity because of this weapons technology. And I think that the subtle anxiety that arises as a result of that knowledge. Remember, we're talking about a generation that witnessed firsthand the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, when the world was on edge, and there was a distinct possibility that the United States and the Soviet Union would engage in nuclear war. And that kind of knowledge, that the possibility of nuclear mega death, I think contributed to a level of anxiety and stress that unknowingly was soothed by the use of marijuana, because it turns out the science now is telling us that the marijuana activates certain receptors in the brain and body that actually ease stress, that turn down stress hormones, that when we feel stressful, there are certain chemicals activated in our body and brain, and that in turn then activates these receptors to sort of dial back the stress. So in a sense, I think young people were embracing marijuana by the millions for the same reason that the older generation was taking pills to help them sleep better at night, to help them feel a little bit better during the day. For the same impulses, I think, drove young people in the 1960s to embrace marijuana. They weren't doing it consciously, thinking that they were taking a medicine. It just made them feel good. It helped them relax, helped them deal with stress a little bit better.
That's an interesting idea.
I think that's what was going on.
Hmm. Well, let's go to the phones now. We have Jason and Kwani with us now. Jason, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to say?
My question is, I had done a paper for marijuana at school. As I researched, I found things about the history, like Mr. Hearst owned a large number of newspapers in America. He also owned thousands of land of trees that helped to feed his newspapers, and he put out slander campaigns against marijuana in order to knock down the competition of hemp and to help get it illegalized to take that competition of that product away to help his paper company. I've also heard that DuPont stood behind it because all of their products were oil-based. I'm just wondering what your guests would have for questions about stuff like that.
Gotcha. Thanks, Jason. So that's a common theory that there were business interests that saw marijuana as competition and helped the campaign to make them illegal.
That is a common theory that's been circulating. It was popularized by a man named Jack Herrera, who played a significant role in the history of marijuana, introducing or reintroducing the notion that hemp was a valuable substance, a valuable plant. And he championed the idea that hemp was a useful plant for medicine, for recreation, for industrial uses, etc. But this notion that Hearst would have jumped on the anti-marijuana bandwagon because of his paper, you know, he wanted to protect the fact that he owned a lot of timber that was making paper, and he saw hemp as a competitor. I don't think ultimately really rings true to me, because his newspaper empire was always in need of more paper. If anything, you would have thought he would have embraced that. I think what motivated Hearst, who was a major proponent of the reefer madness idea, was basically racism. Now, he hated Mexican-Americans. He didn't like the fact that land he owned in Mexico was expropriated during the Mexican Revolution. I think that was a big factor. In terms of the DuPont chemicals and as a competitor to natural petroleum products or natural oil products that could be made from hemp, again, I think that it's possible, but as a journalist, I really like to err on the side of what I can establish as a fact. And while it's a plausible theory, really, there's no evidence for it. So I think that it can be explained what happened largely in terms of the idea that Harry Anslinger sought to expand his own bureaucratic fiefdom. And he did so by demonizing a plant, and he did it with racist demonology. And I think that is sufficient to explain what happened, which is, to my mind, it doesn't mean that what the caller is suggesting might be true or inquiring about. I wouldn't dismiss that, but I haven't seen really the documentation to prove it.
Well, you mentioned kind of the outset of the war on marijuana in 1937. In the 1970s and renewed in around 1980, you spend time looking at the war on drugs and the role of marijuana in that. Talk about that a little.
Well, marijuana prohibition has been a useful tool for political elites to advance their own agenda. For Harry Anslinger, it was to preserve his job and his department. For Richard Nixon, when he was elected in 1968, and for the 5 or 6 years he was in power as president, he used the anti-marijuana law, or the prohibition against marijuana, as a way of basically casting aspersions against the counterculture, against anti-war protesters, against his political enemies, which he associated with the marijuana subculture. And he did that pretty effectively. And Ronald Reagan, when he relaunched the war on drugs that Nixon started, he also was in similar lines. It was a way of symbolically, if not explicitly, attacking a counterculture and a political constituencies that those presidents didn't like.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Pete in Madison. Pete, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for the show and the topic. Actually, that segues perfectly into my question. I was wondering if you and your guest could talk about the cultural aspects of marijuana changing music. For example, Al Aronowitz gets the Beatles high, and then their music changes, and then that sort of, you know, spreads out through the culture. But also not just music, different sorts of thought, whether spiritual or different alternative political philosophies, all seem to be blossoming out of that kind of marijuana psychedelic counterculture.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned about the Beatles turning onto marijuana. That actually happened. The anniversary is quite recently. It was on August 28th, 1 year exactly to the day after the great March on Washington, where Martin Luther King gave his tremendous I Have a Dream speech. Exactly 1 year later, it was Bob Dylan and his buddy Al Aronowitz who turned the Beatles on, who introduced them to marijuana. And that was the height of Beatlemania. And, of course, you know, the Beatles and Bob Dylan were probably the two most influential musical forces during the 1960s. And the fact that they were, you know, avid promoters, if you will, of marijuana. Remember, it was Bob Dylan who sang Everybody Must Get Stoned, and the Beatles made no secret in their music, singing about I'd Love to Turn You On. They were advocates for marijuana, and in a sense, they took the youth of the world with them across the psychoactive threshold. That's how I describe it in the book. And certainly music is a very important leitmotif in the history of cannabis, and it's an important part of Smoke Signals, my book. But it's not just music, as you pointed out. Artists, writers, creative people have claimed that marijuana was a creative catalyst for them, that it helped them with their arts. And it does seem to have an effect in terms of certainly the Beatles, how their music was expressed. The Beatles were, you know, kind of performers on the circuit. When they got into marijuana, they withdrew from that and they took themselves more seriously as artists rather than just as pop stars. So this is a lengthy subject one can go into, but when you look at the history of music in America, you're talking about jazz, country music, reggae, rock and roll, punk, etc. Major figures in all these musical genres,
Martin,
identify very strongly with cannabis.
That's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Martin Lee, author of Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific.
Coming up, we take a look at a new study that says the effects of poverty lead to mental decline and poor decision-making. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a new unexpected ingredient you can use in your cooking, flowers.
Before that, we're talking about a new study on poverty published in the journal Science.
The study found that poverty takes so much mental energy that those under its influence actually apparently have a measurable drop in their IQ. One of the study's authors went so far as to compare being poor to pulling an all-nighter every single night.
So we're speaking about that study now with Anand Imani, an economist at CAGE at the University of Warwick, and she's one of the co-authors of this study. Hello, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well,
glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Well, what questions were you out to answer when you designed the study?
You know, we started out by, as economists, we do think a lot about poverty, as do many other people. And we noticed that there is a lot of research which shows things like people who are poor are, you know, not as attentive parents. They are not not as effective in keeping up with preventive health care regimens. They mismanage their time, you know, they're late for appointments, et cetera, et cetera. And finances, of course. And the question that we wondered about is that, all of these behaviors, is it a cause or is it a consequence of poverty? That was sort of the background which sort of got us into this research. And the specific hypothesis that we wanted to test was, is the very fact of being in a state of financial stress, you know, worried about how you're going to meet the bills next week or next month, you know, what happens when people lose a job, is the financial stress that comes with having to juggle your expenses and manage on a tight budget, does that cause some kind of a brain drain? Does that sap your mental energy so much that you have less attention available to attend to other tasks which may not be your immediate worry, but which nevertheless are quite important?
Now, it sounds like you talked to people both in India and in the United States. Who did you work with for the study?
So we, in New Jersey, we did the study in a mall. So that was one of our experiments, if I may use that word. And in India, we worked with sugarcane farmers in South India. So those were the two sets of people whom we based our results on.
Now, you were talking about how, you know, there's this set of assumptions that sometimes gets made about the poor, that
yes.
they don't work hard enough, that they
yes.
make bad decisions because they're just not focused. And sometimes
yes.
these conclusions are used to form the basis for social policy.
Mm-hmm.
What does your experiment shed light on there in terms of where these decisions come from?
Yeah, so what our paper does, and it's the first paper to show directly that poverty actually causes IQ to drop. With the sugarcane farmers, for instance, we show that the same person, right before the sugarcane harvest, when he's very short on money and therefore financially more stressed, he does worse on IQ tests than he does after harvest, a few weeks after harvest, when he gets the entire year's income and is then flushed with money. So we're saying that the very state of the financial stress because of poverty causes IQ to drop, in the New Jersey Mall study, for instance, roughly by about 13 IQ points. Now, what does that number mean? That's like going from the IQ of a normal adult to something of a chronic alcoholic. So if you descend into chronic alcoholism, that's how much your IQ drops by. Or it's like going from the IQ of an average 45-year-old to an average 60-year-old. Or by comparing with other studies, it's like losing a full night of sleep, and that's an immediate impact. I should mention that in the New Jersey study, this impact is coming just by getting people to think of a hypothetical scenario where they have some kind of car trouble. And basically what we find there is that when we say to people, well, what if this car repair costs $200? What would you do? Would you pay it in full and attend to it? Would you take a loan? Or would you, defer the problem and just keep going? And while they're thinking about it, we give them these IQ tests. And what we find is when the money is amount involved is small, it's just $200, then people, whether they're rich or poor, do just as well on the IQ tests. But when we change the amount to $2,000, just thinking about this hypothetical scenario makes only the poor people then do much worse. And that's where we see this 13-point drop in the IQ that I'm talking about.
So wow. Just so
triggering
that
thought in the shoppers in the mall makes them makes them worry about their own financial situation, and the poor do much worse.
So that is really striking. I want to make sure I understand you. So you're saying if you ask the poor a question about money, if it's this amount that they know, it's a huge amount of money to them, $1,000, their IQ will drop. But if you asked a person who was not worried about money that same question about that same $1,000, they do okay. Right. Their IQ does not drop.
That's right. And when the money is small, when it's $200, relatively small, then even the poor do just as well as people who are rich. There's no difference in their performance.
So I guess what happens is some sort of stress effect kicks in and people's cognitive function declines.
That's right. So people are suddenly preoccupied with their own worries when we present them this hypothetical scenario, and that's that stress, they're not able to then focus on doing the IQ test just as effectively.
And can they bounce back from a dip in IQ like that? How does that work?
So, if I go by the what I find with the sugarcane farmers, absolutely, right? Because what we find is that the same person, we do the studies both about 6 weeks before the harvest and, again, 6 weeks after the harvest, the same person who does much worse before harvest does much better right after it. And we know, because we collected data, this is not driven by them having a lack of food. This is not driven by the effort of harvest, because we had some farmers who, when we interviewed them for the first time, had already finished their harvest, but they hadn't got the money. And these farmers who had finished all the physical effort of having to get things done for the harvest did just as badly when they didn't have the money before, and the same people did much better. They bounced back up after the harvest when they had money. So yes, it is possible to bounce back up, and people do. So it's not something about the innate attribute of a person. It's about how much mental focus they can garner at a certain time, which when they're financially stressed is harder to do.
So we've always had incredible, heated debates about how to handle poverty, both in America and in the world at large. What should this study tell us about how to think about policy as we're crafting it and in dealing with poverty?
So I think the one thing, important thing that we take away message from this study is that when people are in a state of poverty, it's not just that they have less money, it's also that it diminishes their mental capacity. So I think that being just cognizant of that changes, A, how we perceive poor people, and the reasons why they, seem to not get their act together sometimes. And the second thing it says in terms of policy design is that when we design policies to help the poor, it would be much more effective in getting them out of where they are if it would keep in mind that we don't want to load them cognitively. So what do I mean by that? So, for instance, a lot of us are automatically enrolled into, say, you know, pension plans. If the default option was such that a poor person is enrolled into a program and has to, you know, take active effort to enroll out of it, that means much more people are likely to automatically be able to save without having to, you know, sort of actively exert mental effort on a daily or a weekly or a monthly basis to do that. You know, this is, so that's one implication of that.
So make the policies
easier. For example,
easier.
A lot of other programs have a lot of, you know, long forms that need to be filled for people to demonstrate eligibility, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a very interesting study with U.S. data which shows that high school students who are come from poor backgrounds, if somebody gives them help filling a financial aid application form, they are, you know, almost 40% more likely to apply for financial aid and then go on to college. So when you're mentally preoccupied, things that can take off the mental load because of these other factors can make a big difference in terms of how poor people handle their lives. And the same kind of, you know, text reminders about taking medicines at the right time, for instance, could help somebody who is stressed and preoccupied mentally because of it to manage his health much better.
So it sounds like you're advocating making things easier and just more user-friendly for people who are in poverty. But what about something as simple as more compassion?
Oh, I think that more compassion is absolutely, you know, something on the table. It's not necessary. With my first point, if people appreciate that maybe the other people who are poor are the people who are poor are not as different from them. You know, the state of poverty is what is causing them to be, for instance, less attentive parents. And frankly, you know, you and I, if we, for instance, have a time deadline at work and we are suddenly very short of time, just as a poor person may be short of money, we do tend even then to neglect our children a little bit, you know, or eat less healthy. So in some ways, I think the compassion comes from realizing that any person, when he's under stress, be it from time or money, tends to focus only on the immediate fire or immediate task that he needs or she needs to do and neglect other things which are not urgent but potentially important. Now, you and I have deadlines some of the time. If you're very poor, then you're sort of putting out these fires much more frequently. So I think the compassion comes from recognizing that we don't behave very differently when we are scarce on other dimensions. I think that's, so the compassion dimension comes from that. And to the extent that providing these kind of little help and nudges can help poor people attend to matters which are important but not urgent and will make them more effective, I think just that will also change compassion for them, because then the taxpayer sees that whatever dollars are put into anti-poverty programs will actually have a bigger impact. And then everybody feels good about, providing that taxpayer money for the poor.
All right. Well, Anandi, thank you so much for coming on and talking about that today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Anandi Mani, an economist at CAGE at the University of Warwick. She is one of the co-authors of the poverty study we were just discussing.
Next, we're talking to one of WPR's in-house foodies, Lori Skelton, in our Food Friday segment, Cooking with Flowers. What?
Yep. It's true, and we'll be talking about it next. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Noah. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
It's Food Friday here on Central Time, and today we're talking about something a little bit out of the ordinary today with WPR classical music host and in-house foodie, Lori Skelton.
That would be Cooking with Flowers. Lori found a great cookbook called Cooking with Flowers, Savory and Sweet Recipes with Rose Petals, Lilacs, Lavender, and Other Edible Flowers. She experimented, and she's here to tell us about it. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
Welcome to, welcome. It's good to be back, I should say.
What, apart from the book, what grabbed you about the idea of cooking with flowers?
Well, I've had things like stuffed squash blossoms. I've had nasturtiums scattered on top of a salad. I've certainly had cupcakes that were decorated with candied rose petals or candied violets. But then you open up this book, and while this is written by Mish Bacher of Molly B. Sweets in New York, And she's used to making some amazing wedding cakes with flowers. Mm. She's used to making chocolate bars with flowers. But she also has in here things like add sunflower petals to chickpea salad or put them in your carrot cake.
Wow.
And this is opening up a whole lot of things I never thought about that flowers could do. For one thing, she's not just working with roses or violets or elderflowers, the things you kind of automatically gravitate to. She's got recipes in here for nasturtiums and daylilies, and you can do more with orchids than just drop them in your drink. You can do interesting salads with them as well.
It's interesting because my knee-jerk reaction whenever people talk about eating flowers is that I feel really bad. I feel like flowers are our friends. They're beautiful. I don't want to eat them. But then I thought, well, they're in tea, and this is, you know, pretty commonplace there, and I don't feel guilt-ridden when I drink a glass of floral tea. And it does look incredibly beautiful. You're looking at the cookbook now, and there's something that is just really gorgeous about cooking with these flowers. What do flowers do to the flavor of food?
Well, you have a very good start when you talk about tea, because a lot of these recipes will start out with make a decoction or steep the flowers in boiling water and then do something with it. You've had marshmallows, right?
Marshmallows?
Yes.
Yeah.
Would you like a rose-flavored marshmallow?
I guess so. Sure. That sounds good.
And that actually starts off with rose-petal tea. You have, for centuries, been using flowers as medicine. Now, here's a way to take your medicine and give it a little extra oomph in your diet. One thing that we discovered today, one of the things that I brought in actually comes from Troyer's in Loganville, Wisconsin. They actually made earlier this spring dandelion jam.
Oh.
And it's a very pale color, and we just served it on crackers for people to, can you guess what the ingredient is? And one person noted that, yes, it does have a floral quality. It has a very subtle green quality to it. And we started thinking about, are there any recipes where your main ingredient might lose some of that greenness or that earthiness in cooking? Add something like, say, a drizzle of dandelion jam to the top of a pea soup, and you're suddenly putting back that green, fresh element. Somebody said she could see using a flower jam in place of, say, balsamic vinegar, if you want to brighten the taste of your food, but not necessarily have it be sharp or bitter.
Or glazing, like a piece of meat, maybe.
Glazing would be great. And, of course, glazing not only meat, but glazing something sweet as well. A drizzle of, say, chamomile syrup on top of a muffin.
Oh.
And speaking of syrups, I put up Misha Bakker's basic recipe for a flower syrup. 2 cups of petals, a couple of cups of water, 1/2 cup of sugar, and all of a sudden you've got a syrup that you can drizzle on your pancakes or over ice cream or maybe mix into a flute of Prosecco or mix with your gin. It's a real easy way to get started. And right now, hibiscus is available. You can get dry hibiscus in tea all the time. So even if that's not at the market, that'll be an easy one to grab.
Oh, yeah. Hibiscus is a really hot tea flavor right now.
Okay.
I've seen a lot of that, and it's beautiful, and it's got that red color.
And what she's got in here for hibiscus that I really want to try is using dried hibiscus flowers with cayenne pepper and make your own caramel sauce flavored with hibiscus and chili. And serve that over ice cream. But she also says, use your hibiscus tea for popsicles. It's a great way to be a grown-up and still have something to cool down in weather like we've got today. Mm.
I got to try some of the dandelion jam, and I thought I'd use it anywhere I used honey. It was kind of reminding me of a clover honey or something like that. What I didn't get to try was the other thing you made. I heard about it. By the time I went to try it, it was gone.
Well,
it's all gone. What was the other dish? And describe it in detail so I know what I missed.
This is something that I think a lot of people, again, have seen a nasturtium petal or a couple of flowers tossed into their salads. I love nasturtiums. I have them in my garden. If ever I have a BLT that I know has substandard bacon on it, I will grab some of the leaves, which are peppery and sharp, and I'll throw that into my BLT along with the lettuce to snark that up a bit. Nasturtium petals have a pepperiness to them, but it's not as sharp. And so we mixed nasturtium petals in with just basic goat cheese and spread that on crackers. What everybody who tasted it found was, okay, yes, there's heat. Yes, there's a pepper flavor to it, but it's not something that goes straight up your nose and then blocks out every other flavor. This was heat that lingered in the back of your mouth and sort of sank into your tongue.
Sort of like arugula or something, a little peppery or more so?
Actually, a little bit less than arugula. And here was a suggestion somebody came up with that they thought it would be a great accompaniment, not just for a cracker, but maybe drizzled over asparagus. Or this is the one I really want to try. Goat cheese, peppery nasturtium petals, and grilled peaches.
Oh, you can bring that in anytime. Yeah. We'll help you sample that. Yeah, I can't remember what nasturtiums look like, though. Are they a common flower? I'm blanking on exactly a nasturtium. What does it look like?
Nasturtiums are very delicate looking. They have generally five petals that will open wide over their or around their central stamen. Generally, various shades of orange. I have a couple of yellow and a couple of pink ones in my garden. Very delicate looking, but they've got that lovely peppery flavor. You can use these for jam, and this would be a perfect thing to glaze meat with. This would be phenomenal on pork.
Lori, in our last minute, I am probably speaking for a lot of listeners. I'm not sure that I'm convinced that I should start cooking with flowers. Give me and anyone else who's on the fence here a pep talk. Why try flowers?
Because if you are getting used to cooking with herbs like basil or rosemary or thyme, this you can think of flowers the same way you think of herbs. You've got a different element to add dimension, to add complexity, but because it's not a huge ingredient, you're not adding a lot of weight. So I keep coming back to that sunflower petals in your carrot cake. If you want a carrot cake that's got more flavor, but you already know that that batter is pretty stiff, you don't want to be doing too much to add to it. So here is a perfect example.
Sounds gorgeous. And you're eating a little bit of the sun. I like that sunflower idea. Well, Lori, thank you so much for coming in and talking about it. And it was lovely trying that bit of jelly. Hopefully people go to our Facebook page and try out the syrup you mentioned, too. We've been talking to Lori Skelton, Wisconsin Public Radio's classical music host and one of WPR's in-house foodies as well. Coming up Monday on Central Time, it's a special Labor Day edition. We'll find out about age discrimination facing aging baby boomers, making it hard to get back to work after losing a job.
We'll also talk about a growing challenge for working class Americans, job uncertainty making it harder to make big life decisions, things like getting married, having kids.
And our guest will make the case that we should talk about philosophy at the dinner table.
That's coming up Monday, Labor Day, a live show on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll listen to my interview with Ira Glass, host of This American Life. He's speaking at the Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield, Wisconsin, this Saturday night. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.